You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Chefs perform feats behind closed doors in their restaurants, and then, poof, luscious creations suddenly appear as if by magic before our eyes. But in recent years, there has been a movement to demystify food and to empower home cooks. And two women who have been a force behind making this happen are sitting across from me now, Amanda Hesser and Meryl Stubbs. They founded the collaborative online cooking community Food 52, and William Morrow has just published a second volume of seasonal recipes that they've collected from some of the country's most inventive home cooks. I'm really delighted that they could both join me now. Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
So how did this come together? I'm assuming it's partly because both of you live in Brooklyn.
All good things begin in Brooklyn. It actually started when I was working on a big book for the New York Times called The Essential New York Times Cookbook, and Meryl and I did all of the research and testing for that book. And we just had this insight about recipes that come from home cooks, because some of the most popular recipes in the New York Times actually originated with home cooks. And so we felt like there was something there. There was a kind of like the seed of something. And then we were just kind of watching what was going online, and we just felt like there was no place that really kind of allowed, you know, brought together home cooks and celebrated the talented ones and allowed people to participate in that kind of curation of recipes and sort of saying which ones are the best and testing them and photographing them and really taking a community approach to it.
And the reason that, Meryl, you were here is because you have actually studied cooking. Didn't you graduate from Le Cordon Bleu in London?
I did, yes. I went to cooking school at the Cordon Bleu for about a year, and then I worked in kitchens in Boston for a while and moved back to New York. I grew up in New York and actually met Amanda soon thereafter.
Real food editor for Herb Quarterly magazine.
Yes.
Was that a magazine that just focuses on cooking with food?
No,
with
it was it was actually focused on all things herbs, and I did the cooking section of it.
But Amanda, your background has not really been in restaurants, although you did cook for one of the most famous cookbook writers in France for a while as a kind of a home cook.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it really was kind of cooking in her home, even though, of course, she was running the cooking school La Varenne. Anne Willen is her name. But, you know, so Meryl and I both, you know, we both grew up as children of great home cooks. And so I think that, like, home cooking is just, it's in our DNA. It's one of those things that, of course, you cook at home. Of course, you have family recipes. And so it's a natural thing that we would be making a business out of it.
And Meryl, is cooking at home all that different from cooking in a restaurant?
Yeah, I think it really is. I just think that the priorities are often very different for home cooks than they are for chefs. I mean, you know, I think in restaurants, it's a lot of it is about the theater of cooking and the presentation, whereas home cooks are often focused on, you know, getting something on the table in a reasonable amount of time without spending too much money. You know, budget and time are things they think about all the time, but they also don't want to do the same thing every night. They, you know, want to keep things lively. So whether it's tweaking a familiar recipe in many different ways so that it appears different, or, you know, sort of experimenting with familiar techniques and applying them to new ingredients, I think they sort of have a different way of looking at it.
Well, do most home cooks cook from recipes, or are they likely to cook the things they learn from their parents?
I feel like home cooks divide into two groups. Mm-hmm. And it's like those who are like willing and able to follow a recipe and those who kind of look at a recipe and then completely go their own way.
I feel like that's both of our mothers in the second camp.
Yes.
Well, we've seen more and more books recently that encourage people to move on and find their own way with a recipe. Just use the recipe the first time and then personalize it. Is that the way the two of you think?
Well, that's really the history of cooking. You know, that's sort of, I mean, you know, there's a saying that there's no original recipe. And that is true to an extent, because it's sort of, you know, every recipe, you know, that you make, you know, you're kind of naturally, you can't avoid adding your own spin and your own other, you know, influences from your life, whether it's the way you season something or, you know, the way you cook it, or even, you know, the equipment you have in your house. And so, you know, over time, recipes inevitably become your own. And I think that's really what we're celebrating.
Yeah. I mean, both on Food 52, the website, and in both of our books, you know, we include the individual recipes from the home cook authors themselves as they were written, but then we also include some of the notes from community members who've made them and added their input and their tweaks and recommendations, because we really see value in those.
Because some people will say, well, there's just much too much sugar in this recipe.
Yep.
So they'll cut it in half and then discover that they needed a bit more sugar, otherwise because
it
their recipe
work.
Failed.
or they'll discover something entirely new that is even, you know, is better in their view.
Yeah.
I mean, I think the other thing that we do is when somebody adds a recipe to the site, we ask, like, what, you know, tell us about this recipe. How did it come about? And the stories are always great. And they often are like, well, you know, I've been making, you know, Marcella Hazan's tomato sauce for years. And then I wanted to try it, you know, with some new herbs. And then I was doing this baked pasta dish and it became this kind of new style lasagna, you know, and they often originate from other recipes, but they've added their own touches over time.
Or what I've done once in a while is I've merged recipes. I've started off with one, and then I've seen something in another recipe. Hey, what happens if I add that to it?
Yeah.
It works out very often, actually.
So how did you wind up launching Food 52? Were you hoping to create some kind of a community from the start?
I mean, we definitely had a strong theory that if we built it, they would come. But we started with a very specific project in order to sort of test that theory that there were people out there who were looking for a place like Food 52, and that was to build, to create the first crowdsourced curated cookbook in 52 weeks, hence the name Food 52.
I was going to ask you where it came from.
And the way we did that, actually, we did it in a very structured way by running themed recipe contests every week over the course of the year. So, you know, we would ask people to submit their best roast chicken or their best chocolate cake, and people would, you know, upload their recipes to the site, and we read through all of them, as you know, using our expertise as former food editors and writers, and cull them down to a list of recipes that we thought were the most promising, and then tested them ourselves, photographed them beautifully, and presented to finalists, and then the audience got to vote on the winner, and the winners make up the cookbook.
When you look at a recipe, can you immediately spot whether it's going to work or not?
We generally have a good sense of whether, you know, it has potential. The first cut is like, okay, will this work? But what we're really looking for are those, you know, those special details that will make this recipe stand out. That, you know, maybe there's a different technique that we've never thought of doing, or, you know, a flavor combination that seems original and memorable.
Recently, Sam Sifton published a recipe in the New York Times that included a brine with star anise in it. Something I never would have imagined putting into a brine. And I was afraid it was going to make the whole thing taste like licorice. But it was just this most subtle undertone. And it's, you either take the chance or you just say, well, I'll leave the star anise out.
that reminds me of, I mean, one of the recipes in the new book are these spice brined pecans. Who would have ever thought to brine a nut?
Mm.
And you brine them overnight.
They
with
soggy,
spices.
Don't they?
They do get kind of soggy. And then what you do is you dry them in a low oven for like 8 hours, which of course you think you're going to end up with like dust. But they just crisp up and they've absorbed all of this wonderful brine flavor, you know, things like nutmeg and cloves and cinnamon. And it's just, they're absolutely delicious.
Yeah.
My guests are Amanda Hesser and Meryl Stubbs. Their latest book, I can say the latest book, this is the second one, is the Food 52 Cookbook, Volume 2, Seasonal Recipes from Our Kitchens to Yours. It's published by William Morrow. Well, were there ever times when you needed to consult with somebody else? Did you have to go to some other experts if you were a bit confused about whether something was going to work or not?
No, we just try it. I mean, you know, that's where a lot of our experience lies, is in actually testing recipes as well. And we had tested, you know, over 1,000 recipes together for Amanda's book for the New York Times. So we'd had a little experience at that point.
When you did that book, and you were here for it, Amanda, did you change things from the original recipes?
No. I might have clarified if I felt like that was needed, especially for like if it was an old recipe and they were using slightly different recipe writing language. And that's essentially the same principle that we apply to Food 52 and the recipes that are in the Food 52 cookbook, which is that we don't change, we don't improve, we clarify.
Well, I remember looking at really old cookbooks and it would say things like, cook at until it, or braise it until it looks well done. And then they would, you know, nothing was clear. Nothing was ever with teaspoons or cups or anything like that.
Yeah.
And that's the way most people cooked. Did you get recipes like that when you were doing this blog?
Certainly. But actually, we have found that what's interesting is that over time, you know, we've gathered such an amazing group of really talented cooks, and I think they sort of study each other's recipes. I think the recipe writing has actually improved vastly, and it's become much more detailed. I think also the comments, because the thing with the internet is that people can comment, so they get feedback on whether or not their recipe made sense to the average cook.
Well, there is an art to writing a recipe, isn't there, Meryl?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I think a lot of people who haven't done it before think, oh, how complicated can it be? You just say what to do. But, you know, especially I think for more experienced cooks, it can often be even more difficult to write a clear, thorough recipe because there are a lot of assumptions that can sometimes be made if you're experienced.
Well, I found myself in the middle of a recipe and suddenly it says, add the shirred eggs or something. What? Where did that come from?
Yeah. It's really about remembering every little detail. And also I think some of the details that we find most appealing and useful that the home cooks on Food 52 add to their recipe instructions are the really kind of specific visual cues and sensory cues that they write about. So, you know, saying what something should look like when it's finished.
Why have you called this a constructive community?
Because we aren't a community that just gathers kind of to socialize. We actually do things. We make cookbooks. You know, we make apps. We answer each other's questions when you're in the grocery store and are in need of help for a substitution for a recipe or something like that. You know, it's just we really believe in the power of communities to actually accomplish things together.
So you have a hotline.
We have a hotline. That's right. Yes.
Could you tell us about the potlucks and holiday gift swaps that developed when the first book came out? October of last year?
Yeah, so obviously it had been a bit of a long wait before the first book came out. The recipe contest had all happened, you know, the year before on the site, and so everyone was sort of ready for that book to come out. I think that, you know, the people whose recipes were featured in it were excited. And so in order to sort of, you know, celebrate them, and because we couldn't be all, you know, everywhere all across the country at the same time, we encourage people to get together and celebrate amongst themselves and have Food 52 themed potlucks. And so they did. And we had, I think, about 40 potlucks last year that happened all across the country. And in fact, there were a couple that were outside of the United States, too.
And do people write to you and say, I followed the recipe exactly and it turned out awfully?
if people have problems with the recipes, they often will write the comment directly on the recipe page and then have a conversation with the author. That happens a lot.
I'm sure you assumed that they did something wrong, not you. So you published that volume. It was a success. What led you to decide to do a second volume? Just overwhelmed with recipes?
Well, we had actually from the beginning, we planned to do a second book. We were sort of thinking, you know, maybe we would do a book every year. And of course, we found that would be quite difficult on our sleep. Because these are, you know, it takes a lot of work to do this. And so we did the first volume and then we took a month off. And then we decided to actually cut back on the number of contests. We used to do two contests a week. And now we did one a week for the second book. It was much more sane. And now we're sort of thinking about what we're going to do in the future.
But this one is different from the first book.
Well, it's different in that, well, yes, of course, it's new contests. So it was 52 new contests. It's a little bit of a slimmer book, which we feel like is a little bit more manageable for like everyday cooking. And we sort of refined our process and we got the community involved even more in the testing and sort of selecting of the top recipes.
Yeah. And also, I mean, the other thing that we find so great about both of these books is that each one is really a snapshot of a year in time in, you know, for home cooks. You sort of see trends emerging. And so that makes this second book very different from the first.
My guests are Meryl Stubbs and Amanda Hesser, who with the Food 52 community have gone on to create the Food 52 Cookbook Volume 2, Seasonal Recipes from Our Kitchens to Yours, published by William Morrow. And we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Amanda Hesser and Meryl Stubbs to talk about the Food 52 Cookbook Volume 2, Seasonal Recipes from Our Kitchens to Yours, published by William Morrow. And you organize this book into seasonal sections, but unlike most cookbooks, you start with fall.
It's actually because it's where we were when we started the second year of recipes. So we started off in September with our next, you know, our second round of 52 weeks of recipe contests.
But there are also wild card winners.
There are wild, and there are actually more wild card winners in this book than the first. That's another sort of difference. The wild cards are the recipes that we sort of dive into our recipe database and find and test sort of on the sly, and then we kind of, if they're wonderful, we sort of treat them the same way as we do the actual community winners by photographing them and writing a head note, and then we sort of give them a surprise award.
Has the community grown since you began? Are you more likely to see receive recipes from other parts of the world?
I mean, it's still primarily from the U.S., but yes, we definitely have contributions from around the world. I mean, the community has grown tremendously, and there's just more and more wonderful cooks. I mean, now when we have contests, we regularly have, you know, 100 to, you know, a couple hundred entries, really.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a lot of variety, from a Massachusetts-based writer, a father of five, who took a two-year hiatus during which he moved to France to study cooking. His recipe is a roasted red pepper soup with corn and cilantro.
Yes, that's Oui Chef.
Mm-hmm. Is that very French?
I wouldn't say not particularly.
No.
But he's a wonderful cook. You know, he's been trained, and so all of his recipes are super precise and kind of layered with lots of flavors.
And then there's Mrs. Wheelbarrow. These are the names, their online names?
Yes.
I guess it's a she?
Yes, her name, Kathy is her real name.
A landscape designer in Washington, D.C. She gave you lamb merguez. Now, you can get that everywhere. What made her special?
You know, well, it's a great recipe. It's very easy, and you can make it into patties if you don't want to fill it into casings. She is the kind of cook who really likes to make all of her, as many ingredients as possible, kind of from scratch. So something like that, which we think of as an ingredient that you would buy, she likes the challenge of kind of making from scratch, and lots of people in our community do too.
And she's an expert preserver as well.
Yes.
Then there's an optometrist and food lover who lives in Huntington, New York, who sent in a shrimp gumbo, not from New Orleans. And Ali Yak, boy, I'm going to screw this name up, but I think that's the point. Ali Likong, classically trained chef who spent time in the kitchens of Jean-Georges, Devi, and Persay, and she sent in a crispy salt and pepper French toast.
Yes, a savory French toast.
Served with spicy ketchup.
Mm-hmm. It's wonderful.
Is it still called French toast?
You know, in our world, it is.
Do some people send in a lot more recipes than others?
Yes, we certainly have like the classic kind of, you know, power users, people who enter every, you know, week after week, but also people who will test recipes week after week. You know, even, you know, if they're not the kinds of people who write their own recipes, they still may participate on the site in other ways.
Commenting.
Yeah, commenting.
That's part of the community feel here.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But actually being official, like, you know, volunteer testers and all of that.
Yeah.
But also, yeah, some of them have tried the recipe and said, you know, it might be a good idea to shave the Parmesan cheese before you start doing this other part of the recipe.
Right.
Yeah.
Don't end up with shirred eggs in the middle of the recipe.
So in a way, are these recipes still evolving?
I mean, they are, in that people are constantly interacting with them. And I would say the other thing, too, is that, you know, because we are a website, there is the ability for authors to actually go in and edit their recipes after the fact. And that does happen. If a community member points out that a certain step is unclear and the author says, oh, you're so right, thank you for showing me, they'll often go back in and change it so that the recipe does sort of evolve over time.
Well, sometimes recipes, it depends on how you want to write a recipe. Years ago, somebody invited me to work on a cookbook, and I started off with a recipe for guacamole, and after six pages, she said, you know, maybe I better get another writer.
But I was... You're very detailed.
You couldn't have gone wrong following my instructions. On the other hand, it was just guacamole.
Pick up the knife.
Exactly. Well, I actually had you cutting into the avocado without going through the skin, but getting close enough so that you felt the tickle on your palm.
I'd like to read that recipe.
That's a great detail.
Can you tell us about some of the recipes that we've posted online on our show page? They might make for good choices around New Year's, like Kentucky hot toddy.
Yeah, that is a winner. I mean, they're all winners, but that one in particular, I actually tested that for the first time this time of year, and I was in Maine in a very cold, very cold evening, and it just the ticket. It's you actually use Meyer lemon juice and blood orange juice, so you get this gorgeous color. It looks like a sunset, and then you put a little bourbon in. Or
even though
more
this
than
is
a little.
You're sent in by a youth program director. You have to wonder what the kids are drinking.
Exactly. Or maybe the kids, you know, have something to do with needing to have a drink at the end of the day.
Can you get blood oranges at this time of year?
You should,
they're just starting, and also Meyer lemons have just started as well.
And, you know, if you need to make it with regular orange juice, you certainly can. It's just you won't have the same red color, but it still tastes delicious.
Now, do bourbon and citrus juices work well together?
Oh, yeah.
It's a wonderful combo.
It's delicious. And then you add, to make it a hot toddy, you know, it has a little bit of honey in it, and then you add hot water to this combination. So that it's kind of, it's very comforting and soothing.
Mm-hmm. But it doesn't hit you over the head with a sense of alcohol.
Not until later.
And then there's the short rib ragu from a graphic designer and freelance writer in Ringwood, New Jersey. Short ribs have become really popular recently.
Yeah.
And they used to be a really cheap cut of meat. And now they're incredibly expensive, even though you're paying largely for a big bone, aren't you?
Bones and fat. Yeah. Well, we were talking about this recipe, and it's funny because it's sort of layered with umami. You know, it has anchovies in it. It has Worcestershire sauce in it.
Mustard. Dried porcini mushrooms.
Yes.
And then obviously the meat itself.
And gremolata.
And a gremolata.
Yeah.
Which is interesting. I'm talking about sort of themes that emerged over the course of, you know, creating each book. This book in particular, there's definitely a thread of sort of pesto-like, gremolata-like sauces, you know, with fresh herbs chopped up and sort of sprinkled over the top of something cooked.
Well, how do you make gremolata?
So it's chopped parsley, grated lemon zest, and chopped garlic typically. But, you know, you can put a twist on it. You could make it with orange zest if you wanted to. And that's actually what we've seen is a lot of variations. Like the cover recipe has a sage and hazelnut pesto. But it's really kind of like chopped sage and hazelnuts and maybe I think a little bit of cheese.
Yeah, ricotta salata.
Yeah.
Now, when did pesto become more than basil, pine nuts, and garlic and olive oil?
In 2011 on Food 52.
there was a time when that's what pesto was, and now there are all these different kinds of pestos.
Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of nice. It's in some ways, it's like, it's more of an idea, a way of kind of adding a fresh aromatic to a dish.
Well, this ragu is best prepared a day before.
Yes. In fact, the recipe author is sort of adamant about that. I love how it says, you know, you make the ragu and then the next day, make your gremolata.
Takes 3 hours to braise. Do people have that much time?
Well,
you have to have a big refrigerator, too.
Oh, you just have to be home.
Yeah. Yeah, you can get the laundry done, get some work done.
Yeah, you just get it on the stove. I know there's this myth a little bit about like stews and braises that they're kind of big projects, but really they're just about, you know, some chopping and sautéing, and then you let it cook itself.
In an odd way, it's better if you have people coming over for dinner because you don't have to worry about it all coming to the table exactly at the right moment.
Totally.
Yeah.
We think it's like, it's the perfect dinner party or any kind of party dish because you make it the day in advance.
Yeah.
And then what about Midge, who's a Boston journalist who specializes in travel writing, the burnt caramel pudding. Burnt is always a scary word, isn't it?
Not in this case. It's exactly what you want. It's this incredibly rich, obviously, dark caramel that you then mix with cream and I believe there's some vanilla in there and eggs, and then you just bake it very gently, and it's pretty delightful.
And it only uses egg yolks as a setting ingredient.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's not a super firm custard, which is what makes it actually all the more appealing.
Yeah. And it has a little salt on top.
Burnt, actually, we're seeing more and more. For example, a friend makes wonderful chocolate chip cookies with, I guess it would be browned butter, but it's one step away from burnt. And it adds a depth of flavor that you don't get from the typical recipe.
Yeah, the whey and the butter cooks, it toasts, really, and it adds this nuttiness to the flavor.
The problem with this recipe is that it calls for the caramel to brown as far as your nerves allow.
See, that is a great description. That's what we look for in a recipe, is that nice kind of personal experience infused into the recipe writing.
Yeah, makes you feel like the author is in the kitchen with you. I get it. I've been there.
But it also requires a water bath. Now, water baths, you find them in restaurants, the Bain Marie, but...
It's just a bowl of ice.
Yeah, I think it's something that people get unnecessarily worked up about. I mean, you just, have to boil some water and make sure you set your pan in another pan. And just what we always tend to do is put the pan in the oven first and then pour the water once it's resting on the rack so that you don't have to carry the water bath over to the stove.
I was thinking ice bath. Sorry, I just probably confused everyone. I was like, oh, you just put ice in it. No, that's not what you do.
So are you now, when you think about the holiday, are you going to your own cookbook here as a source of inspiration?
We cook from Food 52 all the time.
We do.
Yeah.
Yeah. In fact, I think we both had almost completely Food 52-themed Thanksgivings this year, so... It won't be any different for the rest of the holidays.
Well, how do you get past the fact that there already are so many cookbooks? And I have a friend who says to her husband, do not bring home another cookbook. I don't care how good it is. They're all in the basement. I work from four cookbooks and that's it.
I mean, we both strongly believe in the value of cookbooks as sort of physical objects that are really, it's a sensory experience to page through them. And a lot of people, take them to bed and read them before going to sleep.
So how many cookbooks do you have, Mary?
Oh, my gosh. I couldn't tell you. Hundreds, for sure.
And you're nodding here. Well, Amanda, you've worked on a few, more than a few.
Couple.
You've been responsible for the clutter.
Exactly. It's all my fault.
And proud of it, too, right? So what will you be cooking for the holiday? Do you do special things for these holidays? New Year's Eve, will you be doing something?
New Year's Eve, I'm embarrassed to say I haven't made my plan yet, but I'm guessing I'm going to be with my entire family, so we'll probably collaborate on something. We actually often have a ham this time of year because we just all have a weakness for it, so I'll probably whip up a glaze of some kind.
I was talking the other day to Mark Bittman about whether he and by extension the rest of us should even be thinking about the ethical aspects of the foods that we buy. Should we, because there are so many of holiday dishes really involve politically incorrect ingredients. Do you think about that?
I think we do. I think that we tend to not be extreme in our approach. We, moderation is kind of the key. But I think that, we both are CSA and green market shoppers. I think bought our heritage turkeys for Thanksgiving, that kind of thing. But I don't think that, we try not to, eat fish that are on the kind of threatened lists.
Tell, according to the New York Times, whether you're eating safe ones. Even under those circumstances.
I know. That is true.
So do you tend to do these things with your family? Or are you the one in the kitchen?
The holidays?
Yes.
Oh, I think, as Amanda said, we both came from families who, you know, appreciate cooking. And so, yes, I cook with my mother and sister. I wouldn't say that my dad is the best cook, but he certainly appreciates what we make.
Yeah, well, he's going to hear this.
Sorry, Dad.
Well, some people work well in a kitchen together. Others say, I'd rather do it myself. In some cases, you can get the other person to be the prep chef. You cut up the onions, let your eyes tear while I do all the fancy stuff.
There's always something for people to do. Like my husband, who he'll cook things. He tends to do like one dish, but he'll do the flowers or he'll set the table. And, you know, I think it's just we like being in the kitchen together mm-hmm. and having our kids around. And so it's always fun for people to have something that they're in charge of.
In the back of the book, you have included photos of the contributors. Did you ask them to send them in?
So a lot of people actually on the site have a photo that appears next to their name whenever they show up, make a comment, have a recipe.
So you can just
add whatever photo. But actually for the book, we made sure to track down all the people who did not have photos up on the site or had photos, you know, that were not of their face, that maybe they were of a dish or something. So we do, yeah, we make an effort. We reach out to all of them and ask them to send us a photo because we think it's important to show the faces behind these great recipes.
Well, I don't see your faces here.
Well, we're in there plenty.
Yeah.
Amanda Hesser, Meryl Stubbs, and the Food 52 community. The book, The Food 52 Cookbook, Volume 2. So you say next year I'll be talking to you again about Volume 3?
Yes, we look forward to your guacamole recipe on the site.
I lost that recipe after.
Oh, we were going to have a guacamole contest.
Well, I could probably duplicate it. It takes a long time to make a really good guacamole, by the way. I don't know if you know that.
I don't. Tell us.
Well, I mean, you have all these different ingredients, and either you cut them up by hand or if you put them in a food processor, it's just not the same.
Not the same.
It's true.
I agree.
And I use tomatillos on mine as well. So there's all sorts of stuff that you do this first, you do that second. Do you grind it with kosher salt? Anyway, I feel
a contest that's like your best guacamole with tomatillo.
Ooh.
Coming on.
Okay. Well, this book is published by William Morrow, and my great thanks to both of you for being on our show.
Thanks
for
having
us.